Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're here to unpack complex issues so you can get straight to the insights that matter. Today, we're digging into something pretty fundamental. Open government. You know, the promise that you have a right to see public records to understand what's going on behind the curtain, but what happens when that promise hits a snag? When getting access isn't automatic and people have to fight, maybe even go to court, just to see documents that are supposedly public.
Yeah, that's where it gets interesting and, well, complicated.
Exactly. And our deep dive today centers on a really key Florida case from 1989, Daniels v. Bryson. Now, if you work with or follow open government law, this isn't just some old case.
Mm-hmm. It really shines a light on a couple of very specific, kind of nuanced points within Florida's public records law, that's Chapter 119, points that can, frankly, make or break a case strategy.
Right. So our mission today is pretty focused. We want to unpack two main things from this Daniels opinion. First, whether you can get permanent injunctive relief, basically a court order to stop future violations under Chapter 119.
And second, the whole issue of attorney's fees, how they're awarded, and maybe more importantly, how they're limited. It's often trickier than you might think.
And what's cool is we're sticking just to the court's opinion itself for this. So we get a direct look at how the judges reason through these really critical questions.
Straight from the source.
Okay, so let's set the scene for Daniels v. Bryson. What actually happened here?
Well, it kicked off in 1987. The city of Miami decided to appoint a special investigative panel.
What were they looking into?
Problems within the city's fire department. So pretty quickly after this panel was formed, the Miami Association firefighters, along with one of its officers, they requested documents, you know, records related to the panel and its work.
Standard stuff under public records law, you'd think.
Exactly. And here's a crucial point. The city didn't argue these were secret files or anything. They admitted these were non-confidential public records, subject to disclosure to any citizen under Chapter 119.
Okay, so they agreed the documents were public. Should be simple then, right?
You'd think so. But no. The firefighters, quote, experienced a series of difficulties in obtaining timely, complete production of those records.
Ah, the classic runaround.
Pretty much. It wasn't just a minor hiccup. It was serious enough that they felt they had to sue. Their lawsuit initially asked for the documents themselves, plus damages, and importantly for our discussion, injunctive relief.
So did the lawsuit work initially?
It had some immediate effect, yeah. The trial court granted a temporary injunction back in July 87, ordered the city to produce certain records, and the city did comply with that order.
Okay, progress. But then what?
But then came a twist. In October 1987, so just a few months later, that special investigative panel, it finished its work, issued its final report, and then it disbanded, gone.
Ah. And did the firefighters ask for any more records from that specific panel after it disbanded?
Nope. That's key. No further requests related to that now defunct panel were made.
Interesting. So what happened with the lawsuit then? The panel's gone.
Right. And this leads to a really interesting strategic choice. In March of 88, the firefighters actually dropped their claims for money damages, both compensatory and punitive.
Really? Why?
They decided to go to trial only on the issue of getting a permanent injunction.
An injunction related to a panel that doesn't exist anymore.
Exactly. Seems odd, right? But the trial court actually went along with it. It found the city had shown intentional noncompliance with Chapter 119 in the past regarding those records.
Intentional noncompliance? That sounds serious.
It does. And based on that past conduct, the trial court issued a permanent injunction specifically about the records of that already disbanded panel. It even named Dr. Hattie Daniels, a city employee involved with the records.
Wow. Okay, so the city must have appealed that.
Oh, absolutely. And their main argument on appeal was about that permanent injunction itself. They basically argue, look, you can't get injunctive relief in a Chapter 119 case.
Seriously. They said it's just not a remedy.
Yeah. They claimed the only proper remedy is what's called a writ of mandamus, basically. A court order compelling an official to perform a specific duty, like turning over a specific record right now. They said injunctions are off the table.
Hmm. That seems like a narrow reading. How did the appellate court react to that?
They didn't buy it at all. The court flat out rejected the city's argument. They were really clear.
What did they say?
They held that, yes, injunctive relief is available for a Chapter 119 violation, provided there's an appropriate showing.
An appropriate showing.
Right. And they pointed out that the statute itself, Chapter 119, it in no way specifies the form of the action. It doesn't say you must use mandamus.
So while mandamus is common,
mm-hmm.
maybe the most common way people sue for records.
Exactly. The court acknowledged that. But they stressed it's definitely not the only option. This was a big deal, kind of reinforcing that citizens have potentially broader tools to enforce the law.
Okay, so injunctions are possible. Why did the court think they're generally appropriate for public records cases? What's the reasoning?
Their reasoning focused on the harm caused by withholding records. They said, quote, "The impermissible withholding of documents, otherwise required to be disclosed, constitutes in and of itself irreparable injury."
Irreparable injury, just from not getting the documents.
Yes, because the whole point of Chapter 119 is quick access, to afford disclosure of information without delay. When that's denied, you've suffered harm that, as the court put it, is not ordinarily compensable in damages.
Right, you can't easily put a dollar figure on not having public information when you need it.
Precisely. It's a unique kind of harm.
But they didn't say injunctions are automatic, right? You mentioned an appropriate showing. What does that involve?
Good point. It's not automatic. The court laid out conditions. You need to show a demonstrated pattern of noncompliance with the public records law.
Okay, so past bad acts.
Yes, plus together with a showing of likelihood of future violations. That second part is critical.
Likelihood of future violations. So it's forward-looking.
Exactly. It's not just about what already happened. It's about preventing future harm. And they contrasted this with mandamus. Mandamus, they said, is about compelling a current duty. Give me the record now. It will not lie to prevent future harm.
Okay, that distinction makes sense. Mandamus for now, injunction for the future, potentially.
Yeah.
But hang on. If injunctions are available and the trial court found intentional noncompliance by the city, why did the appellate court reverse the permanent injunction in this specific case?
Ah, yes. The paradox. And the answer comes down to one word. Mootness.
Mootness. Because the panel was gone.
Exactly. Remember, that investigative panel had wrapped up its work and disbanded months before the final court hearing where the permanent injunction was issued.
Right.
So while the trial court did find those past violations, intentional ones even, the appellate court found there was, quote, no finding or showing of a likelihood of future violations specifically related to that particular defunct panel.
So the specific controversy access to that panel's records was effectively over?
Pretty much. The court saw it as moot. There was no ongoing dispute about those specific records because the source of the records, the panel, no longer existed in the same way.
Does that line up with general legal principles in Florida?
It does. The court cited the rule that you generally don't grant an injunction if the complaintive acts are finished and there's no reasonably well-grounded probability that the same conduct will continue in the future.
It's about preventing future harm, not just punishing the past when the specific threat is gone.
That's the idea. And they drew a really helpful contrast with another important case, Board of Public Instruction v. Doran.
What was Doran about?
That involved Florida's public meetings law, the Sunshine Law. In Duran, an injunction was upheld against a school board. Why? Because the board had a proven regular practice of holding secret non-public meetings.
Okay, a pattern.
Yes. And this was crucial. They actually asserted a right to hold those secret meetings.
So they were basically saying, we did it and we think we can keep doing it.
Exactly. That clearly showed a likelihood of future violations. In Daniels, the city might have messed up in the past with the panel records, but they weren't asserting some ongoing right to withhold records from a body that no longer existed. The specific circumstances didn't point to a future threat regarding that panel.
So the lesson here is nuanced. You need the past violations, yes, but crucially, you need evidence suggesting a real risk of future similar violations related to an ongoing issue or entity.
That's the key takeaway for injunctive relief under Daniels. The court was careful. It mentioned injunctions generally shouldn't be blanket orders, just saying obey the law.
Right. You can't just enjoin any possible future violation of Chapter 119.
No. But you can potentially restrain violations that are similar to past ones, but only if there's a real demonstrated danger of them happening again. Past acts alone, especially concerning a finished matter, aren't enough for that permanent injunction.
Okay. That clarifies the injunction part, but lawsuits cost money. What about the attorney's fees?
Right, the other major piece of this case. So the trial court, having found the city acted improperly, also awarded attorney's fees to the firefighters. That's allowed under Section 119.12 of the statute. The prevailing party can recover reasonable enforcement costs.
And how much did the trial court award?
They decided a reasonable hourly rate was $175 per hour.
Yeah.
But they didn't stop there.
Oh.
They applied a multiplier of 2.5 to enhance the fee. This was based on a big Florida Supreme Court case on fees, Florida Patients Compensation Fund v. Roe. So a significantly enhanced award.
A 2.5 multiplier is pretty substantial. So $175 times 2.5 per hour.
Per compensable hour, yes.
Yeah.
But then came the appeal on the fees, and another critical detail emerged.
What was that?
The actual fee agreement between the firefighters and their lawyers.
Ah, the contract.
Exactly. That agreement specified that the lawyers would be paid $90 per hour, flat rate.
$90, not $175.
$90. The agreement also said that if the court awarded statutory fees higher than that, the extra money would go to the lawyers.
Okay. So how did that affect the $175 plus multiplier award?
The appellate court threw out the enhancement. They cited the principle, clarified in cases following Roe, that in no case should the court-awarded fee exceed the fee agreement reached by the attorney and the client.
So the contract caps the award?
Essentially, yes. If you have a standard hourly fee agreement, the court can't force the losing side to pay your lawyer more per hour than you yourself agreed to pay them. That the $175 rate, and especially the multiplier, were invalid because the underlying agreement was for $90 an hour.
Wow. That's a huge takeaway. The initial client agreement can drastically limit what you recover, even if you win, and the court thinks a higher rate is reasonable market value.
Absolutely. It makes that initial negotiation with your lawyer incredibly important for the potential recovery later.
Did the firefighters have any counter argument to that?
They did. They tried to argue their fee arrangement was partially contingent.
How so?
Their logic was, well, anything they got above the $90 base rate was dependent or contingent on winning the case and getting a statutory fee award from the court.
That sounds plausible on the surface. We only get the bonus if we win in court.
It does sound plausible. But the appellate court didn't agree. They look closely at what a contingent fee really means in the context of Roe and related fee cases.
And what's the definition they used?
A true contingent fee, they said, is one where the lawyer receives no compensation when his client does not prevail. Risk is the key.
Okay, so if you lose, the lawyer gets nothing, or maybe just costs.
Right. But in Daniels, the lawyers were getting paid $90 an hour, regardless of whether they won or lost the case overall. That flat hourly rate took away the risk element needed for contingency enhancement.
So the possibility of getting more money from the court didn't make the underlying 90-hour deal contingent.
Correct. Mm-hmm. The court distinguished it from cases where maybe there was a tiny flat fee up front, but a huge risk of non-payment if the case failed. Here, the $90 was guaranteed for the hours worked. No contingency multiplier allowed.
So what was the final outcome on the fees? Did the firefighters get nothing?
No, not nothing. The appellate court reversed the enhanced fee award, but sent it back down to the trial court. They needed to recalculate.
Recalculate based on what?
Based on the hours that were fairly compensable, but capped at that $90 per hour rate from the fee agreement. The court acknowledged the firefighters were clearly the prevailing parties at the preliminary stage. They did force the release of records with the temporary injunction.
So they were entitled to fees under the statute?
Yes. Definitely entitled to the reasonable costs of enforcement, including reasonable attorney's fees. The trial judge just had to figure out the right amount, considering what objectives were sought, how much enforcement was actually achieved, and the time reasonably spent, all while respecting that 90-hour contractual limit.
Okay, that makes sense. So let's try to pull this all together. What are the big takeaways from Daniels v. Bryson for folks dealing with public records law?
Well, two main things stand out, I think. First, on injunctions. Yes, permanent injunctive relief is a tool available under Chapter 119. It's not just mandamus.
But with a big asterisk.
Right, a big asterisk. It's limited. You generally need to show not just past noncompliance, but a real likelihood of future violations regarding an ongoing issue. If the specific problem is over and done with, like with the disbanded panel here, an injunction probably won't fly. Mootness is a real barrier.
And the second big takeaway?
Attorney's fees. While the statute allows prevailing parties to recover fees, which is crucial for access to justice, the Daniels case hammers home that the award amount can be strictly limited by the fee agreement you have with your own lawyer.
A court's idea of a reasonable market rate or a multiplier doesn't override your contract if it's a standard hourly deal.
Exactly. The contract acts as a ceiling in that situation.
So thinking bigger picture, what does this mean for public agencies and for citizens trying to get records?
For public agencies, it's a reminder, maybe a stark one, that consistent prompt compliance is crucial Because even if one specific dispute becomes moot, a pattern of past non-compliance could absolutely be used against you later to justify an injunction if future problems arise. It raises the stakes.
Avoid building that negative track record.
Definitely. And for citizens, requesters, advocacy groups, Daniels clarifies the hurdles. If you're seeking that forward-looking injunctive relief, you need solid evidence of likely future harm, not just past grievances on a closed matter.
And on fees.
Understand the fee agreement you sign. Know how it might limit what you can recover from the other side, even if you win decisively. It shapes the economics of pursuing a case.
It really forces both sides to think strategically, doesn't it? Agencies about avoiding patterns, requesters about proving future risk and negotiating fee agreements carefully.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Which brings us to a final thought for you, our listener, to maybe mull over. Given this ruling, what responsibility does a public agency have to maybe proactively manage its records processes to avoid even the appearance of noncompliance, knowing that building a pattern could lead to injunctions down the road, even if one request becomes moot?
That's a great question. How far does that proactive duty extend?
And how might Daniels influence the legal chess game, the strategies for both agencies and requesters in future Chapter 119 fights? Something to think about. Well, that wraps up our deep dive into Daniels v. Bryson. Thanks for joining us as we explored these important nuances of Florida's public records law.
Yeah, thanks for tuning in.
Keep digging, keep asking questions, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.